So hello and welcome to this Wednesday webcast with me, Scott Cassin-Rennie, Al Coates, and hello. We're delighted to welcome Claire, who is also known as at How to Be Adopted. When I say at, I mean the at sign on social media, at How to Be Adopted. Welcome, Claire.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, guys.
So this is a kind of final webcast on our topic of contact, which has been quite interesting. We've done that for the last month now, and Claire is like this very special guest to kind of not put any pressure on you, but to end it all, and then we're going to move on to something else. So but first of all, Claire, it'd be really useful if you could just introduce yourself to people so that they know who you are and what you do and etc.
Yep, sure, I'd love to. So I'm a UK adoptee, and I am from the kind of what you call the closed era of adoption. So I was recently 40, so that kind of gives you a bit of an idea of the age era in which I was adopted. And I started my blog about almost 3 years ago now. So this was kind of in response to having my children in my early to mid 30s and kind of starting to think a lot more about how adoption had influenced me and my life and my kind of relationships and behaviours. And it's just been going from strength to strength, really. I've had 34,000 visitors to the website. Which is amazing, because I think my mission initially was, if I can just help one other person to not feel like alone or like a weirdo when they're kind of trying to Google some of these topics and some of these issues that I was kind of grappling with.
Yeah.
So that was the aim. I guess it's over the last year or so I've started to become a bit more public. So I've been in Grazia magazine talking about having postnatal depression. After I had my first son and the potential link there with adoption trauma. And I was recently interviewed for Adoptees On. So that's a really, really amazing Canadian podcast. So that would be coming out in a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. So that's really exciting. And I also help run a support group in London for adult adoptees. So it's been running for about 10 years. So I can't take any credit for that, but I've been kind of... kind of helping find speakers and get new members into the group and get us kind of out and about a bit more, going to kind of plays and having outings and stuff. So that's been really, really good. I just can't believe it's one of only a few groups in the UK. Yeah. It's absolutely mind-boggling to me, because I get contacted probably on a weekly basis by an adoptee in the UK who needs support, who's looking for peer support group such as this. That my wish would be to have one in every town and city in the UK.
Because sometimes we can think that it's quite small numbers, but I sort of did some maths and looked through the stats, and there's currently at least 70,000 children who are kind of have been adopted. But when you start to go back 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years, all of a sudden those numbers become really quite big. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because there is a statutory requirement to support anyone who's involved in adoption, but it just seems that that is the sort of the weakest element of the whole system.
I guess probably support for birth parents is probably on a par, maybe even worse, depending on the area. But no, I would agree that adult adoptees we often feel we get the short end of the stick, and it's kind of crazy when you think that children adoptees will eventually become adult adoptees. So it's almost like there's some kind of blinker with the support services and the adoptive parents that their children aren't going to actually become adult adoptees one day. So
That's really interesting, that perspective. I mean, we got you on to talk about contact, and we've kind of already gone off into the long grass, but no, it's quite nice in the long grass. And why do you think that? Because one thing I've noticed is that there is very few voices within, or even on the online community, in relation to adult adopted people. What do you think? Is this something about us as a kind of a culture, or is it just something about our system that means that actually those voices are really quiet?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I guess there's been a few more kind of coming out since I began three years ago, but I would agree that the voices that are out there are probably more American voices, I've noticed. See, I'm not sure what it is about the UK. I think when you meet people in person, they're really happy to share, but not so necessarily keen to share online. I think for me, certainly, there was a fear of saying some of this stuff out loud or publicly, which I think other adoptees have said that they've also experienced. But as I said earlier, if it helps other people, I think it's really, really important. If for those of us who feel able to, then we should. But if not, then obviously nobody should, you know, feel they have to.
Yeah, it shouldn't be compulsory.
And also, I think that kind of follows on maybe from, I'm not going to put a specific year on it, but maybe 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10 years ago when adoptive parents were looking for support and potentially a little bit like what you're describing there. We couldn't find it within our own towns or you know, communities, and we came online when online, especially Twitter. Twitter has been a massive kind of support for a lot of adopted parents. So, you know, but in the early days, more people would have used pseudonyms. Some people now use their real names. I mean, you know, Alan I is an example in that. But it may follow in time where, you know, the more people that actually use a voice to share things, actually it might help to encourage others to do exactly that. Maybe.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think the ultimate aim is to kind of help to try and change the narrative and kind of break down some of those reasons why people don't feel able to share, even though you know that it will really help others. So hopefully we can get there step by step.
And I'm interested to know this genuinely. Do you think that the kind of the voices from America, it makes it sound like there's voices in someone's head, but the voices from America who are very kind of open about some of their experiences and what adoption is like. Do you think that's contributed to some of the people in the UK maybe finding their voice as well? Do you think that's been a part of it?
Yeah, I think so. I think for myself personally, I think the Adoptees On podcast that I mentioned, that's been, I mean, life-changing. And I'm not sort of using that as it's not an understatement. And people like Anne Heffron, who are just really happy to be really open, whether it's like good or bad, happy or sad, you know, and self-publishing is obviously great because you can get things out there without having to, you know, find a publisher. So that's been really good.
Yeah.
Cool. Perhaps we should talk about contact. Contact, yeah. The original reason we got you in. And unfortunately, fortunately for you, you were on holiday. So you were going to come in a bit earlier in the our little series of webcasts and stuff. So can you tell me your kind of experience? I know you've got quite a, it's not an expected kind of experience of contact, isn't it? So just whether you'd be able to share with us your experience and sort of perspective on contact.
So I grew up in a family of four children, two of whom were adopted and two biological children of my parents. So my sister, who was also adopted from a different biological family, she as is quite common for children who've been who have care experienced, she lost some children to the care system, which I didn't realise at the time can be common. I don't know if common is the right word, but it's not as unusual as you may think, that there is like a cycle, which I know is obviously really, really like tragic, and it needs a lot more support to stop stop that happening. And so people can, you know, have a positive outcome and get to keep their babies. So I was in my mid-20s when I lost my nieces and nephews to adoption. So at the time, I didn't really have a voice, like I would say, as I do now. And I didn't really, as I said earlier, understand how adoption had affected me, and I didn't think about adoption with a critical lens as I do now. So as a family, we kind of took what the social workers were saying as as read. We didn't question it.
Yeah.
And we were given letterbox contact with our nieces and nephews, so that would be my mum's grandchildren. So we didn't question it. And actually, looking at it now, I think, well, we were seeing them every kind of 4 to 6 weeks, face to face, cuddles, stories, outings, and then suddenly you're being offered one letter a year that kind of goes, we don't even know where it goes. Does it go into a box and then they get the box of 18 letters when they're 18, or do they get them, are they drip fed them? We didn't know, nobody explained. We were just told, here's an address, you write to this address once a year, be careful what you say, or this kind, we didn't really know what to expect, and we didn't question what we were being offered. And I suppose at that time, maybe I thought, well, adoption was right for me, so I guess it's right for them. But I didn't, as I said, I've moved so far on from those kind of thoughts. I've been doing the letterbox contact for 15 years. Kept that up for 15 years. And now, my nephew, for example, he would write back himself now. So when he was small, his mum would write back, and now he's older, he writes back himself, and we get the photos. And for example, it's all varied. So they're all in a different, situations. So one is in kinship care, one is in long-term foster care, and three were adopted. So it's kind of having the individual relationships with the individual carers and what they are kind of comfortable with. So I definitely feel like, I've almost had to prove myself to kind of prove that I can, I'm allowed to have more contact or phone contact and eventually direct contact with my niece, which was really, really amazing, because her parents found me on Facebook, and they reached out to me and said that they would like to take things away from the social worker letterbox arrangement and kind of go it alone, which obviously we were delighted that they'd reached out. And I saw my niece when she was 8, which was really, really emotional, because I prepared myself that I would never see her again, or maybe never see her again. So that was really amazing. And then my nephew, the last time I spoke to him was when he was 4. And then last week, I actually spoke to him on the phone, which is really amazing. And just as I was about to tell him that I loved him, a rubbish truck drove past. and so me and my niece were really laughing, because I was saying, oh, just pass you back now. And then this kind of like, lorry, hang on a minute, are you still there? but yeah, the really weird thing for me was that, I think about them all the time. I talk about them all the time. I've got pictures of them in my house. All of my best friends will say, how are they? Have you heard from them? And then when I spoke to my nephew, I'm not really sure he kind of really knew who I was.
Yeah.
I'm just this kind of almost like this silhouette of a kind of figure that's kind of been there, but he can't actually remember me. So that was actually quite hard for me, even though I've always said it's whatever they want, and if they don't want contact, that's fine, and I'm just there as an option, and I'm just there as a kind of link to any information they might want about their mum, who's my sister. So I've made them memory books, photos, anything that I know that they would like to know about their mum, I can be that link. But that's as far as my expectation goes, so I don't expect anything from them. But that's not to say that I wasn't a tiny bit like disappointed, I guess, that he kind of didn't really remember me.
You've painted a really interesting picture, because we spoke to Clarissa, and Clarissa, about from a birth parent perspective, but you've really articulated that sense of you are just it's your family, it's your kith and kin, isn't it? But actually you've been sort of lumped into this box of, well, this is what you're going to get, tough, this is it, like it or lump it. So you has that been frustrating? Has that, you know, what's that like?
Yeah, I guess it's just kind of plays into that. I think it's a bit of kind of preconceptions that perhaps adoptive families have about first families. And I would kind of argue that, you know, that's kind of quite an outdated way of looking at things, and it can be quite, I would argue it could be quite damaging to the children, because actually that's where they come from, and biology, you know, it's not something you can ignore. And I often feel like if you're kind of subconsciously, like subliminally telling a child that these relatives don't matter, then you're almost subliminally telling them that they don't matter. And I really do think that it really is up to the children to make their mind up when they're adults, and that it's up to the adoptive parents and the local authority to keep those connections going until such a time, you know, as they get to adulthood and they can kind of try and figure these things out. Because the people that I know that are adopted of all different ages have told me that they find it really, really tricky to kind of form these relationships in later life. And it isn't something that I would say that majority of people will want to try and form these relationships. So in a way, the people that don't facilitate them, the parents that don't facilitate them, are thinking in a short to medium term. They're not thinking about the long body of life and our relationships with our siblings, which go on for the whole of our lives. You know, for better or worse. And it's, you know, it's up to, we need to give people the tools to manage those relationships and the support, rather than just saying, oh well, we tried to do it but you got upset, or we tried to do it but then we didn't really like the look of the other family, you know, and so we didn't bother carrying on. And these are all things that I've heard adoptive parents say, we actually don't want to facilitate contact between these brothers and sisters, because we want the child to form a bond with their adoptive sibling, so somebody else, another child that we've adopted. And I would say that it shouldn't be either or. And that's actually, it's almost, to me, that feels like the child has kind of signed some agreement that they didn't realize they were signing, which said, we will give you a family and home and all the rest of it, but you have to agree to give up this potentially lifelong relationship that could help you with your identity, it could help you with attachments, it could help you to understand your beginnings. Because often, if there isn't a chance to know the birth parents, maybe there's they might no longer be with us, or there could be a good reason why there possibly won't be any contact, then the siblings become even more important, because that's the only person that you can ever sit down and have a proper honest conversation with about where you came from and your beginnings, and the only person that people that you share that with. And to kind of take that away because you're trying to form an artificial family, I don't think that's fair.
It doesn't fit with what we know about families, is that families, we join people to our families through marriage and relationships, new people come into our families, and we don't sort of say, oh, you've only got capacity for three people, I'm afraid. So if you could choose the right three, that would be really helpful. You know, and we as a family, obviously we're quite an odd family, we've got three adults and six children. But my children have accepted that as a total norm. It's peculiar, and children can accept things as normal, can't they? If we say, well, this is your brother, but you can't live with them because of these really, really significant, whatever the circumstance, but rather than just saying, oh, you can't do that, tough.
Yeah. And I do think that, you know, the friends that I know who've struggled in adulthood to form these relationships with siblings, you know, I can't say the answer for sure, but I do know that you know, I've got a friend who met her brother and sister when she was 64. I've got a friend who found a sister in Canada when he was 77. You know, I don't think you can say that your child isn't going to look for their siblings. I think that they are, and whether it's you know, they might not do it till they're 77, but then what you're kind of setting them up to not for that not to be a very easy relationship to then try and build and maintain.
But I mean, that's kind of, it's I guess it's the kind of barbaric, I mean, there's lots of sides to adoption, as we know, but it's almost, you know, that kind of disconnect or kind of just cutting it out is actually quite barbaric. Is that the word I'm looking for? Yeah, probably. Because it is, it's quite kind of, you know, right, that's it, and it's gone. Or it has been in the past. I mean, you know yourself, Claire, there's, you know, families out there that are trying to do it differently now. Do you think that when I say differently now, I'm talking about you know, families who are trying to kind of keep that connection with the birth family and siblings and aunts and uncles and grandparents and all that sort of stuff? But again, you know, there's a lot of people to kind of factor in if it's a big family. But do you feel, having had your experience, that you kind of put pressure on yourself as well to kind of keep this going for your nieces and nephews? Sorry if that's a rough question, but I'm interested to know if it's, you know, if it's just because, you know, sheer love, because it could just well be sheer love for them, you know, but.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I love them, you know, you know, I met them all, you know, pretty much as soon as they were born. I guess it's, if there were other people, so my mum keeps in contact with them, but if there were other people, then maybe we could kind of, share it a bit more equally. But I guess I feel, sometimes I do feel that it's kind of up to me in a way. Yeah. I guess that's kind of what you were alluding to. But, you know, if all I do is kind of keep those links going and kind of keep in touch with the kinship carers, the foster carers, the adoptive parents, and kind of keep those links going, and then step back when it's time to step back, then I would feel that I've done my bit for them, you know, and I just want to advocate for them, because I don't know if anybody else is. You know, I had one social worker who I called, and I just said, look, you know, these kids were adopted in like 2005 and it's now 2019. Will you agree to review the decisions that were made then? And she said, yes, I will review. I'll contact all of the carers and I will put that forward to them. So, you know, why it took me having to call to say, why has this not been reviewed in 15 years? I don't know.
That is a really good question.
You know,
that is. That's quite, I think that's telling of the system as well, isn't it? You know, and how I mean, we've talked about this a couple of times on the previous ones and on the podcast as well, about how sometimes social workers were fearful of kind of coming up with these new ideas. I mean, you know, but actually if it's something that's going to support and help a child who's been, you know, let's face it, taken from their, from you know, their biology, then surely it's just worth even thinking about it, discussing, you know, and just opening up that discussion to make sure that it could potentially help them. You know, it could solve a lot of issues, problems, I don't know, you know, trauma, you know, there's obviously still some trauma there, no matter what happens, but, you know, actually to completely disconnect from what they know and who they know is just so fashioned.
And I would build on that by saying that not only should you consider other relatives, so obviously I'm an aunt, so you could consider, you know, grandparents, aunts, uncles, you know, foster parents, foster siblings. So think outside the box would be one thing I would say, and the other thing I would say is that I would like to move to a situation where it's like an opt out rather than an opt in. So the assumption being that you will have some contact, and the assumption and letterbox would be kind of, to me, like a last resort, because it's so outdated. It doesn't fit with how we kind of communicate these days. You know, and it's not a way to, you know, if, you know, I painted the picture for you earlier, you know, you can't, how can you kind of get that across on, you know, on a page? It's not, even with the best will in the world, you know.
And it's relying on people having good communication skills and being able to write letters, which is an totally outdated form of communication, isn't it? It's safe for the local authorities, but it's not particularly helpful for either party, you know, adopted child or you know, family member. It just seems like we need to shake it up.
Yeah, absolutely. And my nieces, so I asked my nieces if they had anything they wanted to mention, and they said, just to mention how important it is to have the option to reach out to them so that you feel less alone. And one of the foster carers said that she, my niece's foster carer said she finds a lot of adoptive parents say that they will consider contact between siblings and then they don't. And she believes that it does affect them making attachments in later life. So, you know, a lot of foster carers are up for it, you know, so they find that it doesn't go much further.
Yeah, that's interesting. Let's face it, I mean, foster carers have maybe fostered hundreds of children. That's maybe an over-exaggeration, but, you know, maybe tens of children. You know what I mean? Trying to say more than 10 children. What? To facilitate all of that, and as they go through their career, their foster care career, you know, that increases. So the fact that foster carers are kind of willing to kind of take part in that and actually put themselves out, because, you know, they are really putting themselves out to be able to facilitate that sort of stuff as well. And then it's just, it's like you said, it should be opt out. But even then, I think it should be opt out. You know, that is kind
with
of
evidence.
Tell us why. Prove to us why this isn't going to work for those children. And, you know, then it's a kind of discussion point from there. Because, you know, I you know, we have that experience as well, you know, where my two older sons were adopted 15 years ago by us, and their younger brother was adopted as well, and we wanted contact and they disappeared, you know. And that's not on, that's really not on, because, you know, it's, that's not how adoption should work. It's very hard.
Beth Neal's research was, I think she put some out yesterday, or she tweeted someone else's research out, and it was interesting to read the thread. And again, you know, we got accused a few weeks ago of being a bit down on adopters, but the reality is there's a lot of good adopters, right? If you're listening to this, you're probably a good one. that's the reality, or you're probably progressive or open to the idea,
open-minded.
It's the people who, or the families that fit, for whatever reason, whether that's anxiety, that's fear, that's nervousness, who kind of then go, I don't want this. It's too much like hard work. It feels too risky. They're the ones that need support.
Yeah, and I would say to those people that majority of children, when they become teenagers, they will try and find their siblings on social media.
Yep.
So one of my nieces was trying to find her brother, and she added 400 people with the same first name because she knows his first name, and that's all she knows. You know, so, and that's absolutely tragic. Why should she be, you know, doing that without any support? Mm. And what answer are the parents going to give them, that brother and sister, when they do find each other, because they will, what answer? Yeah. You know, if you can look your kids in the eye and give them a damn good reason why you kept them from their brothers and sisters.
Mm. Yeah. And that was our experience, that three of my children have a sibling, and she just applied herself to the internet and found us, which was great.
Yeah.
But you can't fill that intervening years. That ship has sailed. You just can't replace that, which is heartbreaking for so many siblings and grandparents, aunties, uncles, you know, all of that. School teachers. And I'm conscious that it's 1 minute to 8 o'clock and I turn into a pumpkin or something. Is there anything that we didn't ask you that you were hoping we would ask you? Or any sort of closing thoughts?
No, I think that's all. I've got my notes here. But I think peer support is the one thing that a lot of adoptees in their sort of 20s are kind of telling me that they're lacking. So they're not sure whether they're just falling between the gaps. But when it comes to searching for and connecting with siblings, they really feel like they're kind of just out on a limb. Mm. And one person in particular, she had several siblings, and it kind of ranged from being rejected by the siblings outright to kind of ones being really, really over the top and kind of too intense. And she absolutely had no support. She was doing this all on her own, you know. And so that would be the thing that if you want to help the adoptees of the future, then we need this support in place, and it needs to be sort of up and running if it's going to help your kids in the future.
Just on that peer support bit, I mean, you know, social workers have kind of peer support, adoptive parents have peer support, foster carers have peer support. I think the work that I've done in some of the regional adoption agencies that have been set up, there's a younger kind of age group that are getting support. But they have to want to engage in it, obviously. Is that the right age? You know, 15, 16, maybe, you know, I mean, for some, it obviously is, because there's still, you know, these peer support groups are happening and are working. But I think from what I see, and you might disagree, Claire, but there's a kind of point where adoption, they some people don't want to really think like that. They don't want to think about it. They want to do whatever it is they want to do, but they'll come back to it. Would that be kind of right? Do you think that's maybe one of the reasons why the peer support isn't kind of there for the later adult, the more mature adopted adult, shall we say? I don't know. I'm just putting it out there as a kind of, you know, because I don't know, but, you know, I'm just saying I see it for the teens. You know, there's a lot of kind of support trying to happen in some of these regional adoption agencies for the teens.
Yeah, and I think that's why this particular friend who's kind of mid to late 20s was saying, you know, kind of feels like the support that is there is kind of finished by that kind of age. But, you know, I think you make a good point, Scott. I think that had you offered me some peer support at that age, I probably would have said, I'm not interested, I don't need it. Absolutely fine, thank you very much. it's just about making it available as and when, you know, different life stages crop up. You know, I needed to use the post-adoption centre helpline just before I got married. So I had a few kind of jitters around sort of birth family, coming to the wedding, not coming to the wedding. And I found them really helpful. But of course, you know, that's one helpline, you know, to cover the whole of the UK.
So. Yeah, of course, yeah. And very underfunded as well, I would say. So, yeah. Interesting.
I do find it fascinating, and I think
I
think Scott and I probably would say that the best thing for us about the podcast, forget everyone else, stuff them, is that we've had the opportunity to talk to lots of people who've been adopted, and I think that's been transformative for my thinking.
Just massively.
A range of experiences, not just one voice, or, you know, the happy adoptee or the angry adoptee, the myriad of perspectives, of which you're one.
I would just totally agree with that. For once we're agreeing out, and I think the last 18 months actually listening to adopted people and adoptees has really made me change how I want to use the word parent, because obviously I still parent a younger child, but also the way I speak to my adopted adults, you know, it really has changed, because actually the open and honesty that I can give to them now with confidence, because actually, you know, let's face it, they always knew that they were adopted, having two dads, you know, that was never going to go, how did that happen? You know? But, you know, I still think there's still some of those kind of traditionalists who, you know, feel like they want to fill a void of having a baby or having a kind of child that's theirs and all that sort of stuff. And I think that can have an impact on it as well. But I'm waffling now. Sorry, Al. I knew that would happen. I'm kind of in awe because Claire's been so open and honest with us, and I just feel like it's been a bit of a therapy session, actually.
It does. I feel so much better. Claire, where can people get in touch with you? What are your links and URLs and all that kind of stuff?
So my website is howtobeadopted.com. My email is howtobeadopted@gmail.com, and my Twitter and Instagram handles are @howtobeadopted.
That brand narrative, that is just the brand narrative is fantastic there. You're on fire.
Loving your work, Claire. Loving your work.
We want sweatbands, headband, t-shirts, the whole thing.
Sticks of rock.
Mouse mats.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I'd love a personalised mouse mat. I would, but...
We all live in hope. Well, Claire, thank you so much. Really appreciate you coming on. And just if people are listening and they got this far, listening to Scott and me, next week we're going to be talking to Satwinder Sandhu, and we're going to start talking about race and racism and adoption. And we're terrified because we're so white. We're so white.
Two white men talking about that, seriously. That's just not...
Wiser minds than Amazon. Okay, well, thank you very much. And I'm going to stop the stream now. So thanks very much, Claire.
Thank you, guys.